Bring the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:05 p.m. on Monday, January 30th, 2012. Let the record reflect the following members are present. Representative Kawasaki, Representative Dick, Representative Herron, Representative Gartner, Representative Foster, and Representative Wilson will be is delayed. She has a bill up in another committee right now. Co-Chair Seaton and myself, Co-Chair Feige. The purpose of our meeting today is to hear House Joint Resolution 31, which is to declare Central Park a wilderness by Representative Kyle Johansson. And we will also begin hearings on House Bill 276, the oil and gas production tax credits for the Nenana Basin by Representative Steve Thompson. Well, let's see. Representative Johansson, you're up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill today. If I might, Mr. Chairman, just briefly describe the motivation and how I came to this bill being introduced, and then go on from there. Quite a few years ago, I had the opportunity to take a train from Boston to New York City for the first time to see New York. And the closer you got, the dirtier and more disgusting New York City was. And I spent a couple days there, and there was this green, basically an oasis in the middle of Manhattan Island. Every other portion of the island that I went to was covered in concrete or blacktop or whatever other substance that we probably don't want to put on the record. So a few years later, I'm on the Internet looking around, just kind of passing the time, and went to National Geographic. And they had an entire project to go back to Manhattan Island the day before Henry Hudson stepped foot on the island and to try and find out what sort of flora and fauna and what was the ecosystems, et cetera, et cetera. And they have an entire website, and they spent a couple years on it. It's really a very interesting study done by the National Geographic, and that's where the text of all the animals and plants and such that you'll find in the resolution came from, directly from that website and their research. So just kind of thinking about ANWR and where the most of the money and activity of the groups that want to shut down ANWR. You know, Manhattan is really the epicenter of finance and some say culture in the United States, and a lot of stuff comes out of Manhattan, New York City. So everybody pretty much in America, I would say, has an idea what Central Park is. It's an icon. It's something everybody can relate to. And I started thinking about how we can make the point about what we want to do in Alaska with ANWR, and felt that Central Park would be a good issue that could raise the level of discussion about what we're trying to do in Alaska. Over the past few years, actually since Bill Clinton vetoed legislation many years ago, we've had the same conversation. It's been consistent, it's been a little bit boring, and it's just kind of hitting our head against the wall in the exact same way. And I did not expect this to take off like it did, but I did want to make a point. And when this was introduced, I was pleased to have immediately on the same day, I believe, the Speaker of the House sign on as a co-sponsor. Mr. Chairman, you signed on as a co-sponsor. And a few other people on the House immediately, because I think hopefully that people recognize this is something that could get some attention and some discussion. Since then, Mr. Chairman, our own AP reporter, Becky Borer, wrote a story that was picked up by the New York Times, and from there it has spread from New York City to Alaska, California. It's been picked up by Huffington Post, The Atlantic Monthly, New York Magazine, obviously all the Alaska networks. It has been spread throughout the country. If you Google my name and Central Park in the same line, you get 15 pages of references to this particular resolution. And I would argue that since the time that that bill was on President Clinton's desk and was vetoed, that there has not been a discussion nationwide about ANWR. And this is not about the inside baseball. We send a resolution to other politicians, and they look at it and go, wow, this is a neat resolution. Okay, you want to open Anwar, we get it. This is about people in small towns and big cities across the country sharing through Facebook, through tweets, through blogs, and it is just going all over the place. And people are talking about our biggest issue in the state. We've been working on Anwar for years. And this is a real ground-up, grassroots discussion that is moving up, and people are talking to their representatives and senators about it. Coincidentally, we have Anwar legislation in the House back east right now that's being marked up and hopefully should move out of the Resources Committee to the House floor for a vote in the next week or two. So I think it's really relevant right now. Again, I did not, for the life of me, believe that it would actually start what it started, but it's all over the country. People are talking about it. In fact, I found a website that was, I don't know what language it was. I think it was Danish or German. All I could see was my name and Central Park. And they were talking about it. So it's going all over the place. So admittedly, it's most likely not going to happen, obviously. But another point I'd like to make is if the federal government wanted it to happen, it would happen. If the federal government decided that Central Park was indeed going to be a wilderness area, there's nothing in the world that could stop them from doing it. And that's how I feel about Alaska and some of the ideas that they have about our land and how we should be able to develop it. And then one final point, Mr. Chairman. When the Times reposted their story, they got a quote from the parks director, and those are the folks who are in charge of Central Park, and they run for the city of New York. And the director mentioned that in the 70s, New York City was running a massive deficit, and they didn't know how to balance their books. And they were looking at all options to figure out what can we do to make our budget balance. One of the proposals in the study was to give Central Park to the federal government. And the city fathers at that time, faced with huge deficits, had the discussion that if we do that, Central Park will be in control of the feds, and we won't have any say about how our park is managed. We will lose complete control. We won't have a voice because the feds won't listen to us. I think that really summed up where I was trying to go with this. And I'm glad you're hearing it today, and I would certainly appreciate your support in getting this past the House and over to the other body. And I know there's very enthusiastic folks waiting for this to move. So, and I did have about four or five groups call me this morning asking if there was an opportunity for public testimony. There are groups that are actually in the building who were imitating school teachers over the summer, but they're some real positive resource development groups and business groups in the building who were very excited about testifying and in the spirit of getting this in front of you and to your wishes of not taking too much time on it, I asked them to refrain from coming in and testifying in person. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Johansson. Any questions from the committee at this time?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Representative Johansson, thank you for the resolution. In your comments, indicated that the likelihood of this happening is less than other resolutions that we pass around here. But would you consider that an amendment that short of getting that designation for wilderness, that maybe they could the land could be returned to the appropriate tribe?
Mr. Chairman, in the resolution, the Lenape, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, tribe was indigenous in 1609 when Henry Hudson did land on those shores. And they are mentioned. We sent a copy to their they have an organization like most tribes do. We haven't heard back from them yet, but any amendment or accentuation of their particular perspective on this issue, I'd be more than happy to expand on there. We referenced them but didn't get a chance to talk to them specifically about adding more language. But, yeah, certainly open to do that.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. And is I understand the intent of the message, and hopefully it does generate some dialogue that can help Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Yeah, if anything, I signed on to the bill because the point does need to be made. I can't tell you how many passengers over the years I've had from Manhattan Island that have come up to Alaska and ridden around in the back of my airplane. And to them, it's a completely eye-opening experience. They have no real basis even for knowing what a wilderness is. And anything we can do as a legislature to raise their level of knowledge, or at least get them to pay a little closer attention. We certainly already accomplished this with the article that showed up in the New York Times. So the point really is to raise the issue, and you know, there's a lot of restrictions that get attached to a wilderness area designation. And like the city fathers of New York, that we're certainly looking out for the people of New York by resisting the federalization of Central Park. You know, we need to look out for the increasingly federalization and federal control over over Alaska. So hopefully this will send a message, and in the end, that'll be the you know, the biggest point that the resolution drives home. Are there anything else from the committee? Representative Kalasaki?
Are we on comments, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
I appreciate the humor in which this might have been written, and for some of the members that this is a humorous topic. But I think most importantly, what we got to remember is this is a huge waste of the committee's time. I feel almost complicit that I have to say that it's a huge waste of time. But there are at least 35 bills in the committee currently dealing with everything from energy to bringing natural gas to Fairbanks, and those bills have sat in committee for over for about a year now. And I think that we need, as a committee, a laser focus on energy bills and how we deal with energy across the state. I think that this resolution passing this committee is going to be a complete backfire. I think that people in the lower 48 already have sort of a negative opinion of Alaskans. Because of the Simpsons movie, they think that we're all paid to live here, right? You hear that on and on from constituents, that we're from people outside in the lower 48. Because of a former governor and Saturday Night Live, they all think we're illiterate. And now you can add to the list, if we pass this resolution, that we are petty and juvenile legislators. I think that this resolution has to go down in this committee. I think we can write a letter. I think there's lots of other ways to approach it. But if you really want to prove that this state is smart enough and ready to develop our own resources, then we have to act like adults. And I don't think that this resolution gets to that point. I'm going to not support it out of committee, and I won't support it on the House floor.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. After the resolution was introduced, I had comments from several people on email, and none of them were happy. And I defended it. I said it's a serious topic and a humorous way of drawing attention to it. And one person came back and said, I want to know what it costs to have it drafted and have it heard and all of this. I said, you know, I'm not going to put any time into that. That's the end of the line. We're finished with it. It's made its point. Much greater than the sponsor anticipated, and greater press coverage on it. But now I'm going to have to contact this person and maybe try to give him a figure what it's costing to keep hearing it and moving it forward. So that's my comment. I'm only here. I agree with the previous speaker that there are other things we should be focusing on in this committee, and I'm here only out of respect for the process because I feel like it's a waste of my time to be here today right now.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, do you mind if I wrap up?
Go ahead, Mr. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I just want to say I certainly respect the opinions of the two members to my immediate left and right, but really we're talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We're talking about opening up something that this state has fought extremely hard for, and I understand that this was written in a satirical manner on purpose to get attention, but to say that this is petty, juvenile, and a complete waste of time, I think, is inaccurate. Any time that we can bring the issue of opening ANWR up to America to get more oil in the pipe, we're not going to be building science halls in Fairbanks. We're not going to be building a road to Nome. We're not going to be able to support anything in this state if we don't get our resources developed. And while I admit this is written in a way to draw attention and with satire, it is effective. There has not been this much attention to ANWR since President Clinton vetoed our last chance to get it opened. So I respectfully disagree that this is a waste of time. This is the biggest issue this state fights for every single year. And we're making progress. We're going to get a bill out of the House of Representatives. We take baby steps. And so the committee will do what it will do under the guidance of the chairman. But I think not continuing this bill on shows a greater message to America that, hey, you know what, they're not even going to pass a bill that we've been talking about. Imagine what the blogs are going to say if this thing doesn't pass. It's going to be a huge negative, in my opinion. This is a positive, positive discussion that's happening for the first time across the entire United States. Go back to your office and Google it and look. Everybody's talking about it. And they're going to talk to their legislators about it. I mean, it's extremely important to me that we take this seriously. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hanton. At this time, we'll take a brief at ease and round up Representative Thompson next door from the Judiciary Committee. I'd like to open up the presentation on House Bill 276, sponsored by Representative Thompson from Fairbanks. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Steve Thompson from District 10. First, I'd like to thank the chairman and the committee for affording us the opportunity to present House Bill 276. House Bill 276 is designed to incentivize exploratory drilling in the unexplored Nenana Basin. As all of you well know, the interior and Fairbanks is suffering from high cost of energy, high cost of heating for homes. People have heating and electric bills that are approaching and exceeding their house payment, which is unacceptable. This 50 miles from Fairbanks, a high possible yielding gas and oil, is very important to the interior, the rail belt, and could alleviate a lot of our problems with economic development. And we have problems with buildings waiting to be built in Fairbanks, but there is no natural gas, and they won't be built until we get some relief. If you look at the amount of money that we have as a potential here to go out to tax credits, and then compare it to the fact that there's bills that the TCE would include Fairbanks, the amount of money that the state would spend on power cost equalization in the Fairbanks area could amount to $30 million a year. The cost of building a pipeline from the North Slope to Fairbanks to get relief for energy costs would be way be more money than what we would have a possibility of spending on this bill. So this particular bill has a potential to help the interior, Fairbanks, and the rail belt, and it's something I think that is very positive. When you start looking at the cost of natural gas at the wellhead, there's not a lot of incentive for investment. This would incentivize getting this done, hopefully in an expedited manner, in a close area to Fairbanks, and relieve a lot of energy problems. My chief of staff, Jane Pearson, is going to give a rundown on the bill and a sectional for you and answer questions. So I am in a meeting next door, and I am going to leave, but if she needs me to come back, she'll come drag me back out of there. And again, thank you for hearing House Bill 276.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. House Bill 276 is really a policy call for the legislature. It is another exploration tax incentive bill, one that you've heard the representative talk about for the reasons why it is important to the interior and especially to Fairbanks. It will strongly encourage investment in the high potential Nenana Basin and it's designed for the to incentivize exploration drilling, which is a great benefit for the state because they get the data. It will also help to bring investors to the table. This has been a problem when natural gas prices are as low as they are and shale exploration has taken center stage. The Niniana Basin, although remote, has great access to transportation and transmission. The basin is located in an underdeveloped region of Alaska. However, the basin is 50 highway miles from Fairbanks and 280 highway miles from the South Central Gas System. And additionally, the basin lays adjacent to the Alaska Railroad System and major power transmission system. HB 276 offers tax credits to the first three persons that drill an exploration well to the depth of 8,000 feet for the purposes of discovering gas or oil. The first person that drills the exploration well is credited at 100% of the cost, or $25 million, whichever is less. The second exploration well drilled is entitled to a credit of 90%, or $22.5 million. The third exploration well is credited at 80%, or up to $20 million. If the exploration results in sustained oil and gas production from a reservoir discovered, then 50% of the credits awarded will be repaid to the state. So the policy question really comes at a time when Fairbanks, the second largest city in Alaska, has reached a tipping point. This has been one of the coldest winters in history. I know personally I have already paid equal to what I paid last year in diesel up to this point, and it's really going to hurt. residents are really having to decide between staying warm and paying for necessities. We think this could really expedite getting more dependable, more reasonable cost energy into the interior. We already are having supply problems that prevent us from growing our industry at all. And I really believe that incentivizing exploration in basins that are located near energy-starved regions of Alaska will show high production potential is a step which will help support Alaska's economy. It may very well get us off of programs that we fund year to year for a one-time funding mechanism. And I think sustained production in these regions is a good solution. And that is really what I have to say. And if anybody has questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them or to give them to.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Pearson. We have two versions of the bill in the folders. See a version, what's it, version A and version M? I'm sorry, version B and version M. Let me get those right. Version A and a version M. Which one is the preferred alternative here?
Chairman Feige, the M version, the CS, is the preferred alternative, and the change in this is the repayment of the credit would be in equal monthly installments over a 10-year period commencing 60 days after the start of sustained production. This payback provision is just a lot cleaner than version A that called for a monthly installment greater than 1/240th of the total amount of the credit, or 10% of the gross value for the month preceding the month the payment is due. This is a clean payment, repayment.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt committee substitute 276 as our working version.
And hearing no objections, we'll adopt version M as our working version of the bill. Let's see. Some questions. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Jane, for being here. Can you tell me where the this House bill, sort of the genesis of where the numbers and sort of the percentages for exploration came from? It's important to the discussion, I think.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. We modeled this after the Cook Inlet exploration legislation that went through last session and two sessions ago and really did create a stampede of exploration.
Yeah, I just, and also to add, Mr. Chairman, just to sort of clarify that the the language in the bill is almost specific to what we, again, in the Cook Inlet region, you know, arguably at the time the debate went, the Cook Inlet region has already been explored quite a bit. This is really incentivizing an area that we know to have gas from as early as 1963, but just for a lot of reasons hasn't been picked up as a good natural basin. But with folks that are currently exploring, with future explorers, this makes a lot of sense for interior Alaska, not just for Fairbanks, but for South and Nanana, over across down the river to local villages. And I think that this is a great way to get us there. Thanks.
Representative Gardner, you had a question?
I don't know quite how I want to phrase this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it seems to me that any time we offer 100% of costs, regardless of the outcome, we put ourselves on fragile ground. I mean, somebody who knows nothing whatsoever about choosing, doesn't have a good track record, could be the first person to respond, and we get nowhere, but we've spent $25 million. That's a concern for me.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I understand your concern, and I think that is a very valid concern. Currently, we have one company exploring in that region, which is Doyon. They have had trouble with their investors because of the price of gas. One thing that we did gain a lot of information from 1999, when they drilled two wells previously, the information that was gleaned was very helpful to the state. I think when Bob Swenson talks, you'll see how that developed the basin and how we're looking at the basin now. And this is really the hard question where the policy comes in that is up for, you know, this committee and the legislature to decide.
May I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Do you know how many wells Doyon has drilled altogether?
My belief is that they drilled two wells.
Okay.
And when I talked to Jim Mary, who should be online and can give you more information, their belief is that maybe they drilled not in the right place and they'd be looking to drill further north.
Thank you.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was asked Jane to put on the record this question and then other people that testify behind her if they could answer to this question, so what's on the record. So, Jane, of course, you referenced a Cook Inlet. Now we're considering legislation for this basin. Could there be legislation where it could be essentially a template where we don't have to go back in and legislate specific basins or areas for this type of exploration credit?
Representative Herron, through the chair, I think that is a great question, and I think that is really something for this committee to look at. I think when Mr. Swenson speaks to you, you'll see maybe some of the other basins that have been underexplored and frontier basins that could very well fall into this kind of model.
So, Mr. Chairman, I just yielded that to you. Just make sure that they answer that generic question for the other people that testify.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Dick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jane, I was just curious as to where we came up with the 8,000 feet. As I was trying to do homework on this, I heard that some of the wells out there have already been drilled to 11 or 13,000. I don't know enough about drilling. Why 8,000 feet?
Representative Dick, through the chair, this is the number that we came up with when we were working with Ledge Legal. We do have meetings scheduled with DNR and with DOR to further discuss some of the finer points of the bill. But this is our belief that this is the, I'm not going to say it right, tertiary.
Tertiary.
And that would be the level that gas would be found at.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had several questions. The first is that, you know, on page 2, line 7, it's the first three persons that drill an exploration well. So as I'm seeing this, unlike the Cook Inlet Basin where it was one operator that would drill wells for three different companies, this is first three persons, and I'm trying to figure out the persons, if that's the drilling company, or is that the owner of the resource that is contracting? And we could have a resource owner or a lessee contract with a drilling company to come in and drill, and I'm trying to figure out this relationship between the producer or the lessee of the gas resource, which is, I believe, in Cook Inlet Basin, the one that gets the credit, versus here, it seems like it's a drilling company that's going to get this tax credit. Was that the way this is intended, or is that for a more technical conversation?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that is my understanding, that it would be for the actual lessee of the land, because they could bring in another drilling company, or, you know, they'd still have to pay the drilling company, so it would be a pass-through, you know, for them.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
So for clarification, the intent of this language is that this would go to the person that had the lease, not the driller, not the first three persons that drill.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that is my understanding, and if I am wrong, hopefully somebody will correct me.
Okay, and at this time, I'm not. I'm just trying to clarify the bill and what it's supposed to doing. Okay. And I guess my next question was, we had a couple of wells drilled in this basin based on the 40% tax credit that was offered. And I can see why we want to enhance drilling. I'm a little concerned about the 100% the same way, because it's 100% up to $25 million. And as Pedro Van Meers talked to the legislature in its recent presentation, if you get too high a tax credit, there's absolutely no incentive to control costs, because you get the full amount reimbursed, whatever you expend. So just to kind of put on the record, I'm not trying to put you on the spot about answering that, but I want to put the issue out there that we'd be asking is the 100% and the 90%, is there some level, whether it's 80%, or that gets us to that enough skin in the game by the actual lessee driller to make sure that they control costs in. And so that's what I'm worried about. And I'm also a little concerned if you've investigated the $25 million cap. I know the $25 million cap was there for bringing a jackup rig from some other part of the world into Cook Inlet and establishing that. And I would like to get some kind of cost estimate between a land-based drilling operation and the operation where we had a jackup rig that's got to be brought in and mobbed and demobbed over several seasons in the ice and in Cook Inlet. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to lay out a couple of issues that as we go forward people can address, and if I might, one more, and that was that it was talked about the cost of gas at the wellhead has been a problem. And I guess my question is, the wellhead cost of gas, we have Fairbanks having a very high price of natural gas right now. It's trucked the, you know, from Cook Inlet up as LNG, so you lose all that that gas that you use in the conversion process and the expensive trucking. So if we do find gas at 50 miles away from Fairbanks, maybe as this goes forward, we can get some development of why we would anticipate a low wellhead price of gas when most of the cost, the high cost, is taken in the transportation and the LNG conversion currently. So those are just issues I'd like to address. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know what your average per kilowatt cost is up there, as well as maybe average heating oil cost?
Representative Foster, through the chair, I pay approximately 22 cents per kilowatt, and I am currently paying over $4 a gallon for heating.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other members of the committee? All right, thank you. We have several people in the room to give further testimony on this bill. Bob Swenson, the director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Also in the room, Dan Stickle from Department of Revenue, where he's the chief economist in the tax division. And online, Jim Mary from Doyon will be available. There's several folks available online to answer questions. So, Mr. Swenson, if you would introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Swenson. I'm the state geologist and the director of the Alaska Geological and Geophysical Survey. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I think most of you know that I do enjoy talking about the state's geology, and I think it plays a huge part in the discussion that will be ongoing about the bill that you have before you.
Brief it is. Test.
My dad comes back tonight.
Test.
Then he goes.
I can hear you on
the okay. Brother comes back.
Coming over the top.
We'll go.
Okay, we'll call the meeting back in order just so the members of the committee are aware. Slight malfunction with the sound system. The red light that normally indicates whether the system is on or off is going to stay illuminated. When we call in at ease, make sure the green light on your mics goes out. That will indicate that the sound system is off. So right now we are back in order. Back to Mr. Swenson, if you could start for purposes of the recorder, start from the top.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bob Swenson. I'm the state geologist and director of the State Geological and Geophysical Survey. And I do appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. I think this is an important topic for everybody, and what I'd like to do is present a overview starting regionally, looking at all the sedimentary basins in Alaska. I won't go into any detail, but put that into the context and focus down in on the Nanana Basin and what we know about many of the basins in the state, as well as focus in on what we've learned about the Nanana Basin in the last 5 years. I will state for the record that as a recovering Luddite, I usually do have that effect on computer systems and sound systems. So what you see on the screen before you is an outcrop of what we're looking at when we're looking for oil and gas. This is the bluff just outside of Homer. This is the type of stratigraphy, type of rock that we produce a tremendous amount of the gas in the Cook Inlet out of. You can see the black layers in there. Those are all layers of coal. And in between those layers are layers of sandstone, mudstone, siltstone that were all laid down in a non-marine setting. And I'm going to be going into a fair bit of detail about this. But this is what we call in the state of Alaska the tertiary basins. And that refers to a time period, the most recent time period. And as you'll be seeing, that's primarily the age of deposition in most of these basins. And they're also, likewise, nearly all non-marine. But they all do have variances, and some of them quite large variances. So this slide here of the state of Alaska shows the distribution of the population centers in the light blue dots that you see, as well as the infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure that we see around the state. And the next overlay here are the tertiary basins that I was referring to. These are the areas that you have relatively modern sediments, the sediments that we saw in that outcrop photo distributed around the state. You see a dramatic amount of those basins are actually in the offshore regions, the Bering Strait regions, as well as Beaufort Sea, Cook Inlet, Kodiak Shelf, and the Gulf of Alaska. However, we do have some fairly significant basins within interior Alaska. Now, looking at from this satellite-type view, it looks like these basins are very, very large. They are in similar size and aerial extent to many of the other basins that we are currently producing oil and gas from. But like any geology that we look at, I think it's important that we delve a little bit deeper into and look at the details, because each one of these basins that we'll talk about have a lot of variances. They do have some similarities, and I'll just briefly go through those. And if possible, I'd like to have this as a conversation, Mr. Chairman, if it pleases the chair. If there are any questions, please jump in. I have no problem with trying to answer questions for you as we go along. One of the things about Alaska, the geology here is incredibly complex. I don't think that's not something everybody doesn't quite understand. It's clear that just given the topography, the variance in that variations we see in the orientations of all our mountain ranges, all the volcanoes, which are in this diagram, all the little red triangles, the blue that you see are actually earthquake focal locations, and it's related to the downgoing slab on the Pacific plate. And you can see that that's actually moving in that general direction at about 63 millimeters a year. That's about the rate that your fingernail grows. And so that's why we see a tremendous amount of the tectonic activity that we do see in this state. That's drives the volcanic systems, it drives the seismic systems, it creates a lot of deformation in the state, and it has also made our geology very complex. As far as the interior basins go, as far as the sedimentary basins in the state, one of the big driving mechanisms are the huge strike slip systems that run that traverse nearly the entire state. The black lines that you see on that diagram, the further south is the Castle Mountain Fault System. The central system is the one everybody knows about. That's the Denali Fault System. Mount McKinley is uplifted because of motion on that. And in 2002, we just had a relatively large earthquake on that system. But to the north, we also have a number of these huge strike slip crustal scale, earth crustal scale type faults, the Tintina and Caltag Fault System to the north. Motion on these faults in the last 80 million years has actually created a tremendous variance in the geology of the state, and that's what we're going to talk about now. But that's what drives it, that downgoing slab, the crustal scale motions, and the uplift and subsidence of different areas associated with that create these places where we get deposition of what's eroding off the surrounding mountain ranges. And this is this slide here tries to explain that in a little bit more detail. You can see in the block diagram up on the upper left side of this slide, you can see I have arrows in the areas where there's uplift. The two black lines, the vertical black lines, represent some of the faults associated with these big crustal scale faults and motion. And uplift and erosion of those areas that are then transports that sediment into a basin that is actually subsiding. And so as that basin subsides, the meandering rivers, the photo that you see on the right, will take the sediment that is derived from the uplifting areas and deposit it in that basin. As that basin continues to subside, because of the huge tectonics that are going on in the state, as that basin continues to subside, you can put down tremendous thicknesses of this stratigraphy. And what the stratigraphy is, if you look on the photo on the right, you have this meandering channel that's running across this plain. You also see the discontinuous lines. Those are related to point bars and other different types of depositional systems of that river. Those end up being the reservoirs within an oil and gas system. It's the sandstone that's deposited in the high energy environments. The things that you see in between there, the pond there, the peat bogs, all of those, what they end up being are lacustrine sediments, lake-type sediments. They have lots of organics in it. That's what gives us the source rock. In the Cook Inlet and many of these basins, it's going to be biogenic gas. And if it gets buried deep enough, if we have a long enough history with enough sediment coming into the basin, you can actually get what's called thermogenic gas, where you cook that or those organics, and it produces either gas or gas only, depending on the kerogen type, or possibly oil if it has the right type of kerogen. And the kerogen is what the different bugs and things that are being deposited within that system. After the basin is developed, after you've done all this many times, because all the tectonics, all the mountain building, all that continues on throughout the entire process, you can end up taking and uplifting that. Those rocks that were once deposited in the subsiding basin, folding those rocks, doing all kinds of deformation to it, and uplifting it to the surface. The photo on the bottom left is an example of that. It shows which was once a meandering stream, now is a bluff along the East Homer coast or the west side of Kitchimack Bay. And you can see, again, the coals that are associated with the bogs and the sandstones associated with the river systems.
Representative Kawasaki, you had a question?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Bob. Question for you on, can you just explain whether these types of basins are large reservoir-type basins, or are they the types typical for fracking that they've got in Lower 48 or gotcha. Somewhere in between, or do we not yet know?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Any of the basins, like especially a non-marine system like this, when the sandstone is deposited in the river system, just like if you're standing on the river fishing or something, the sand kind of moves around your feet. Oftentimes it's relatively loose. If it doesn't get buried very deep, the porosity permeability within that sand remains incredibly high. The Sterling Formation in the Cook Inlet, where our primary gas source in the Cook Inlet, is that type of system. Very, very clean. Lots and lots and lots and lots of sand, and that makes it high porosity, high permeability. You don't see. It's a conventional reservoir. You actually can take a piece of Sterling Formation when it's turned into rock. It usually isn't very lithified, but you literally can blow through it because there's that much porosity and permeability in it. As you bury that deeper, what happens is that gets compacted, and all those little pore spaces and the sand grains move around. And actually, if you get deep enough, those sand grains will deform, and you lose that porosity permeability. Plus, you start, because you're getting higher in temperature and you're putting a lot of different chemistry waters through it, you can change some of the sediments that's been deposited into clays, and that'll plug up those pore spaces as well. So it's a long answer to your question, and I'm sorry about that. But basically, you have the full suite of possibilities in any one of these systems. You can have very, very tight rocks, so unconventional tight sand type clays, all the way through very, very high porosity permeability conventional sands. Two big issues associated with any one of these basins is the seal. That's the very, very tight rock that keeps the gas or the oil from migrating up section. You have to have that. You have to have lots of clays and mudstones in the system to stop that from just vertical migration. And you also need to have a petroleum system and an operating petroleum system. One of the good things about any one of these basins is the fact that you probably will have two petroleum systems, one associated with coals. That's the biogenic gas, that the coals never were buried deep enough to actually generate thermogenic or thermal-type hydrocarbons. But the bugs eating all the plant material and everything, as that's subsiding, you end up with a biogenic system. So any one of these basins, that's a very long answer to your question, but any one of these basins will have a full suite of possibilities. But each one of those pieces have to be there.
Thank you.
And I will continue. As I mentioned, what can happen in the late stages of any basin development, this is a seismic section, a two-dimensional seismic section across the west side of the Cook Inlet. These are two very large fields on the west side of the inlet, Granite Point and the Middle Ground Shoal.
what can happen in these basins after you lay down all this sediment up to 25 to 30,000 feet of this sediment, so over 5 miles of sandstone coals and all of this, the tectonics in the regional sense can then compress that basin. It changes from a subsidence to a compression event, and you end up with folds like this. The vertical scale here, what you're looking at, is about 4 miles from the surface all the way to the bottom of the diagram. Now, if you were to drill a well in one of these big folds like this, and this is in the Cook Inlet again, and that red line would represent that well that you drilled down into, this is what you would end up seeing in many of these basins. This is a series of wells that is along the crest of the Blue River gas field. And so each one of these represents a well, and then there's correlation between the coals and the sandstones in between. Everything yellow on that diagram is reservoir. Everything black on that diagram, the lines in there, are all the coals. And there's production from the top to the bottom of this. And so this is what you'd expect to see laterally. Lots of complexities, lots of variation, that type of system. Okay, so what about the rest of the state? We kind of looked at the Cook Inlet where we have a lot. One of the issues on this plot that you see is all the exploration wells in the state are plotted here. And you can see that there's a very high focus in exploration, both on the North Slope and in the Cook Inlet areas. That's a very important point. One of the issues there is, yet you have proven petroleum systems working. We have 1.4 billion barrels of oil, I believe, out of the Cook Inlet, and clearly over 8 TCF of gas has been discovered and is in producing right now, as well as on the North Slope. Everybody knows the resource numbers there. What we don't have is a very good understanding of the subsurface in the other basins. All these other areas on this diagram that show as light green are the areas that are currently the basins within interior Alaska. The gray areas are the basins in offshore Alaska, which I won't go into right now. At some point in time, I can certainly talk to that.
Question on that slide. The data in terms of drill logs and any wireline work mm-hmm. that was done, how much of that data is public that other companies can come in and research through your facility?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question. A significant amount of the data is available to the public. The electric well logs, AOGCC has statute to collect a full suite of the electric well logs. That's the information they pull from the well by running a series of different types of electric logs in the well. Also, cuttings from the drilling. We keep those at the Geologic Materials Center out in Eagle River. Cuttings from each one of the exploration wells in 10 to 30 foot increments, as well as some portion of core that is taken. And so there is a fair amount of information that is available to the public. In fact, that's another talk that I can certainly give you about how much data we do have in the state. One of the issues that we see here, and there's another thing that's very important on this slide, and then you can see the yellow boxes, and I apologize, they're very difficult to see. But on the North Slope and in the Cook Inlet, we have a lease sale system, and I'm not the expert. The Division of Oil and Gas certainly are the experts on the lease sales in the state. But the other boxes that you see in the Susitna Basin or in the center in the Nanana Basin area, that's part of a program that was initiated, I believe, back in the late 1990s, the expiration licensing program. There's a very different way to bring in companies. It is a competitive process, and I think it would be important for this committee to hear exactly what that process is. For one reason, because the Nanana Basin and many of the other interior basins currently are leased in that manner. Okay, now I'm going to start digging down here and moving down into a series of basins. One of the things that clearly is...
Just a second. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you. Before you go on, when we're talking about exploration licenses, those cover large areas. So can you have overlay in that, or with the bill that we're talking about, does that mean that only the one person that has the exploration license would be eligible for this bill?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. I am not the expert to answer specifics on the exploration licensing, but basically there is a competitive process through work commitment. And the companies will come to the Division of Oil and Gas with a work commitment, and the exploration license area will be defined. There will be a term limit on that, that the work has to be done, and the data is returned back to the state. At that point in time, then there is, they can go to any part of within that license area and go to lease on it, and then it becomes a normal oil and gas lease to the state. Now, the whole process from the very beginning to end, unlike having an open lease sale where everybody goes and just bids on certain lease paths, it allows a company to come in, look at a very large area that is a high-risk area, do a significant amount of work to try to help define what the prospects are, and then go to lease on those specific prospects without worrying that somebody else can come in that meantime while they do that seismic work or gravity work or other work and pick up those leases out from underneath them. But I think it would be important for oil and gas to talk to that.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I didn't need the exact answer right now, but it's something that I want to make sure that we have oil and gas come forward. So if the sponsor would, or yourself, would arrange for that, I think that that's something that we're going to have before we, you know, complete our hearing.
We do have Bill Barron online to answer questions, and perhaps at the end of Mr. Swenson's presentation.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues with the state of Alaska is that it is so large, it is so complex geologically. We have a tremendous amount of data, as you referenced, Mr. Chairman. It's important that we try to get all of that data accessible to people all over the state. And so back in 2005, I partnered with the Alaska Energy Authority. We were collecting data on all renewables, water, hydro, wind, and biomass, and amassing that for the state. One of the things that we didn't have a good database for was all the geologic information. And so I partnered with AEA, partnered with the Division of Oil and Gas, and we went through a process of putting together a website. It's going to be available to the public, all the data that's available on all renewables as well as oil and gas, as well as coal, will be available through this website. One of the products from that is here. This is a report that's in final review right now. It basically goes across the entire state with all the different areas, sub-areas that are defined through Alaska Energy Authority, and provides information on what available data is there within the system, public data, for any coal, gas, or geothermal information that the state or other public entities may have. We broke the state into a number of different regions. Those regions are, as you can see in the small inset map, those regions are broke out the same as the Alaska Energy Authority map or Energy Authority areas. Another thing that's very important in this is to just see that when you start getting into the geology, the very complex, all those different colors, all of those black lines attest to the complexity of what we see in interior Alaska. And we've looked at each one of these areas and amassed all the data that we can get access to in the public realm. And these are just a few of the pictures of a few of those areas. And what we'll focus down in on now is the Nanana Basin. But first, I'll drop to the Susitna Basin. The next phase of this project is to look at what data is available, what data is needed to help assess the petroleum potential of these basins, and then what we need to do to go out to gather additional data that gets us to a point that attracts the industry to explore in these areas. And so this data will all become public through time. This area in Susitna Basin, we started field work on last year. We will be starting on the Nanana Basin next year, looking at the outcrops surrounding those basins. The Landston, we'll move now to the Nanana Basin. This is the land status map, and you can see the license area in that tan color. This is the license area that we were talking to. The green land blocks that you see are conveyed native lands. The blue are selected native lands, and the red are allotments. And the dark blue are federal acreage. All the white acres that you see on the around the license area is state lands that is currently open to mineral entry. and I am just about finished. I'll be moving down. What I'd like to do is go from the initial phases, what we knew about the Nanana Basin. The first presentation I ever gave to the legislature was in Fairbanks, and it was on the Nanana Basin back in about 2005. So I've watched the development of this basin quite with a lot of interest. It's a very small, in relative terms, in relative to the North Slope and the Cook Inlet, but what turns out to be is a very deep basin. This is what the information that we had early on. This is back in about 2003, the initial understanding. These contours, you can see the different colors. As it goes to a dark gray, that means it gets deeper and deeper. As it gets blue and then to a very, very light gray, that's getting shallower and very thin. You can see there were two wells drilled, and I'll have some of the details in the next couple of slides on the Unocal Nanana 1 and Arco Totec Tails 1. And that is about the extent of our understanding. There were some old seismic lines that had fairly poor resolution on it. And at that point in time, we felt that the Nanana Basin was possibly, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if you go back to the previous slide.
Certainly.
Just to give the committee an idea of the contours and the those are the thickness from top to bottom. So yes. Obviously the top is the surface, and the bottom would be,
yes,
I think, believe what's called basement rock.
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly right.
Okay.
Yes, this is a structural contour, so the colors represent the thickness of that basin. The deeper, darker colors, and thank you for that clarification, in this case, get to 18,000 feet with the understanding that we have. This was based on remote sensing data called gravity and modeling of that remote sensing data. Thanks for the clarification, Mr. Chairman. Here's what we understood about the basin back at that time, pre-2009. About 18,000 feet thick. It's time equivalent in stratigraphy to the Cook Inlet, but has a very different set of stratigraphy in it. The potential for oil at that point in time was looked at to be very low due to the thin organic source rocks and the thermal history that we assumed the basin had with about 18,000 feet of fill. The range of possible outcomes for white was wide and poorly constrained. There were two wells drilled. However, they were drilled on basement highs, and so they were drilled where the basin proper actually was relatively thin, and you'll see this in the next slide. The first one drilled in 1962 to 3,000 feet, and the second one drilled to 3,500 feet. And remember, the basin thickness is up to 18,000 with this level of interpretation. We also thought there'd probably be a lot of deformation, in other words, building of traps in the southern part of the margin of the basin. Since that time, there's been a number of seismic lines shot, and this was under the exploration license that Doyon has. A number of seismic lines were shot across the basin, as well as the Nunavak number one well was drilled. What this well did was help us correlate all the other data that we had. And this is the recent data that was put forth, and I'm sure the committee will have Doyon come and give a presentation on that data. It was published in Oil and Gas Journal on January 9th of 2012, and I'll just go over a few of this very significant findings. It turns out that the basin, once the gravity data and the seismic data were calibrated to the well information, it could be up to 25,000 feet thick. That has a huge variance on the thermal history, because the deeper you get, the hotter you get, as well as the fetch area and the amount of potential you might have for thermogenic-type hydrocarbons. There's a thick Paleocene section that was encountered. This was a big surprise, and I'll show you on the next slide why that was. Paleocene, in this case, turns out that had a number of trace oil and gas shows in it. Now, you see this often when you see trace oil. That means that the geologist, as he's looking at the samples coming over out of the drill core, he can get just a trace of hydrocarbon there. The only thing that really tells you is that you most likely, at least in a local sense, have an operating petroleum system. And that's probably one of the key aspects of any one of these basins, is to understand whether at least you have that. There's a number of other hurdles you must jump to get to the prospectivity stage, but an operating petroleum system certainly is one of them. They also did a geochemical analysis on the coals that they brought up over and other samples that they thought had high organic content. And to everyone's surprise, they had both high HI, which stands for hydrogen indices, as well as S2 values. And while all that, I won't go into the geochemistry of that, but what that says is that coals, which very, very seldom have oil potential, depending, they have to be very specific types of coals, in this basin appear in that Paleocene section, which we didn't know existed, actually has some oil potential, which changes the prospectivity of the basin. And then they did basin history modeling based on the data they got from the well, and it shows that they believe they have an active petroleum system. This is what the cross-section looked like before they drilled the well. It just, and I won't go into all the details, this would be a cross-section of the earth. You can see the north flank of the Alaska Range, what the exposure on the north flank of the Alaska Range had, and then what was encountered in the two wells and what they expected to see in the well that was drilled in 2009. You'll see at the bottom of part of that well, in that column, they had all those question marks. That's the Paleocene section that they ran into. They didn't know that that was going to exist. That's where they saw the high HI values and the variance and also the thickness, the total thickness of what they expect the basin to be. So, in summary, there are a number of basins across the state. We only talked about the Nanana today. The Yukon Flats, there are a number of basins in west central Alaska, and there certainly are basins that extend out into the Bering Strait. Many of these basins have similar geometries. Many of these basins have similar topography, but each one of them has a very unique history, and that's what's very important for this talk to get across in this talk. Because of all those big faults that you see coming through the middle of the state, because of that type of geology that goes on, they're going to have different types of geologic history, which is important to their petroleum potential. They're non-typical petroleum systems.
Is that on the record?
Let the record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Wilson, and Representative Munoz has been with us since about 1:10.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very little is known about the subsurface geology in most of these basins, and that's probably one of the big problems, is that we can make assumptions, as you saw what happened to the Nanana Basin. We started out with some gravity, two wells on the edge. Most of these basins had zero subsurface information. So we make inferences based on the gravity work and other things, but the models are very poorly constrained. And so it's very difficult for geologists to say this is exactly what that potential is. As you gain more information, as you get more data, that clearly tightens up the model that you have. There is potential probably in many of these basins for biogenic gas and possibly in some of the basins for thermogenic gas, but that is poorly understood. And from an exploration standpoint, I guess I would say I've been in the exploration business for many, many years. These really are wildcat basins. They're unlike the where you have 3D seismic data. You have lots and lots and lots and lots of information to do your drilling. These are back, seem to be in the older times when a lot of wildcat, as we used to call them, wildcat-type wells are drilled. However, there was a lot of oil and gas found in those types of wells. So with that, I'll certainly take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Swenson. Getting back to your point about wildcat exploration targets, in your judgment, what are the odds that
that's the hot seat? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I think, you know, you can actually, and I could, you know, bring up the statistics on all of this. But depending on the level of information that you have in any play, a wildcat exploration target usually is somewhere between 5 to 15% chance of success. And you can also talk about geologic success versus economic success. And as you go from geologic to economic, then the chance factors drop. Now, one very important point of that is that there are two different types of chance factor variables, and I apologize to go on, but this is a very important point. There's negative information and there's a lack of information. Your chance factors for success on any kind of an exploration well can be because you have negative information that says, you've drilled part of the basin and there's no petroleum system. The chance factor then obviously is going to go down. The other side of the coin of that, however, is that if you don't have enough information and there's too many unknowns, that chance factor still has to be low. It may be that it exists, it's just that you don't know it. And so it's very difficult from Wildcat standpoint to make that distinction. The more data you have, the less Wildcat it becomes, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So the benefit of the Nunavak number one was not that it found oil, but it basically expanded our knowledge of the geology and
very much
discovered a layer that we didn't expect to be there.
That's exactly right.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Are the ARCO and Unocal wells still active exploration wells?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, no, those were drilled, one in 66, I believe, and the other in 82, and have been plugged and abandoned. Okay. They drilled it, and they were relatively shallow wells. They didn't see what they expected to see. They got down into what's called basement rock, or some non-prospective rock, very shallow. And those have been plugged and abandoned for many years.
Mm-hmm. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned that there's very little data out there for a lot of these basins.
Mm-hmm.
And ARCO, back in the 80s, they drilled in the Norton Sound area mm-hmm. there. Because that information is 30 years old now and with the advance of technology,
mm-hmm.
Would that information be considered obsolete now?
Representative Foster, to the chair, very good question. No, not at all. In fact, I won't pull this up, but I've got a couple of slides on the Norton Basin specifically. And all the data, the technology at the time was not able to gather the amount of information that we can now gather in any one of these operations. However, it's usually very critical data. Some of the most critical data is just a sample of the rock. Just having, if there's a core that was taken, the cuttings, if there's just a piece of the rock, that you can make determinations on all types of different geologic parameters, it's incredibly important to have that. And I'll put a plug in for our Geologic Material Center. That is why that is so important, is that going back to an area, going back to a Totec Hills or something, the fact that we have core, the fact that we were able to look at it, dramatically changes our ability to understand the basin as new data comes in.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. First of all, with the drilling that was done in the Anna Basin, and they did identify what they think is an active mm-hmm. petroleum system, meaning that there's organics that have been changing. So with the core and everything that was done there, was it a porosity problem that would be identifiable or solvable through the new techniques that we're using, lateral drilling hydraulically fracturing, right, so that you get porosity, or was it identified as no seal layer in there? And so I'm just trying to figure out what the failure,
right,
for development in that well, or what the explanation is.
Yeah. Representative Seaton, through the chair, that is another good question. And like any dry hole, like any time we drill and spend a lot of money and drill a dry hole, postmortem is probably the most important thing for the entire deal, to understand what you learned from what you encountered. For any trap to actually end up with an accumulation of hydrocarbon, it's astounding how many different variables have to fall into place, how many pieces of that puzzle have to be right. That's why this chance factors, that's why on Wildcat, in not understanding how much is there, that the chance factors are relatively low. The more data you get, the more those pieces fall into place. And so the ARCO Totec Hills and the Unocal, it's really hard to say exactly what it was. They didn't see accumulation. Now, that can happen from a number of reasons. You're outside of the migration pathway, because once it's generated, it's got to migrate, and it'll migrate in an up-dip direction, and it can go in many, many different directions. It could have been seal problems, but most likely you did not have a reasonable or viable trap. And so all of those different issues probably played to that, plus the fact that within a biogenic system, unlike the thermogenic system, within a biogenic system, it's almost works in reverse of the thermogenic, and so it's generated as it's being deposited and subsiding. The bugs are eating on things, and they produce methane gas, and it actually goes into solution in the in situ waters and all this, and it requires a bit of uplift because it reduces pressure and temperature on the fluids and also on the coals where the gas is adsorbed to, and that reduction in pressure temperature then releases the gas and it migrates up. Very, very different in a thermogenic system, which is going down, it generates and expels it out. And so in that case, it takes the uplift. That's why it's important, like the cross-section that you saw, it's important that you have a huge amount of uplift. That's why we have these huge 2 TCF fields in the Cook Inlet, because there was so much uplift and so much of that gas was dissolved or adsolved out of a solution and brought into the formation. Sorry, and there's another long... Sorry about that.
Follow-up.
Yeah, and my second question was, you know, we're in relationship to the bill that we're looking at, mm-hmm. My understanding is that we've got some old, not very good 2D seismic, and I'm trying to figure out the relationship of credits for let's go out and drill a well if we don't have very good information, or is the state better off giving credit for 3D seismic work, right, in which case we may much more specifically target the exploration that's going to take place?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I misspoke there. The older seismic that I was referring to, that's actually seismic that was shot back when ARCO drilled in 1982. Since that time, Doyen has actually gone in and acquired seismic as part of the exploration licensing program. They've gone in and acquired a fairly robust 2D grid of seismic. And, in fact, on their handout out in the hallway, I did see that they posted that. They've also posted on there where they would like to shoot more seismic to the north. So getting additional seismic for understanding what the prospectivity is really part of that. But when they drilled their well, the Nunavak number one, they actually had a fair seismic grid to go by. They shot the seismic, identified where the prospect was, and used the new seismic to identify that. It just turned out that it wasn't in the correct place. The prospect turned out to be a dry hole.
So I guess just one more follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
And that would be on the seismic. Is the seismic, as you see the bill before you, is that included in the credit for a well, or is that a separate issue that needs to be looked at outside of or in addition to the basin bill that we have before us?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, if you don't mind, I would like to defer that to the Division of Oil and Gas. I think they would be able to help with a much more information on that, because you're going to have a difference between the exploration licensing as well as then the credit that's before you in this bill. So I think it'd be important for them to weigh in on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swenson. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you all listening.
Online, we have James Mary. He's a Senior Vice President of Lands for Doyon. Is he still online?
Hello.
Yeah, Mr. Mary, if you would, state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is James Mary. I'm the Senior Vice President for Lands and Natural Resources at Doyon Limited in Fairbanks. Doyon is the ANCSA Regional Corporation for Interior Alaska, as most of you know. We have over 18,000 shareholders and several subsidiary businesses here in Alaska, and actually a couple of outside, with a strong emphasis on oil field support services and other natural resource development. And Doyon is also the largest private landowner in Alaska, with about 12.5 million acres in the interior. Personally, I'm a proud 31-year employee of Doyon and a 35-year resident of interior Alaska. I guess I have to do a couple of disclaimers. I'm not a geoscientist, though I employ and manage several who provided input for this testimony. And I speak really only for Doyon, not the other investors in the project. Also point out that this bill was really not introduced at the request of Doyon. We were approached recently by legislators, Senator Wagner specifically, who wanted to do something for Nanana modeled on the Cook Inlet jackup rig incentive legislation, which sparked a lot of new activity, as you all know, in Cook Inlet and an apparent discovery as well. The similar incentives in the bill before you present an opportunity, I think, to do things at the nano which might not otherwise happen, or to do more things and do them sooner, all on state of Alaska lands there. And especially when you consider the risks of frontier exploration and the topsy-turvy world of Alaska gas markets and politics, which I want to speak to more a little bit later. But first, I think I need to give you a short history of our project and a status update. And Doyon is an investor with several other companies in exploring the basin. And although Doyon has the largest single equity ownership at 60%, and for the last year, Doyon has been the operator, which is the day-to-day manager of the project. Doyon's investment started several years ago at only 20%, but we've upped it over time, and I think our current ownership shows our commitment and belief in the project. The other participants in the project are a Denver company called Rampart Energy, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Yosubeli Energy, and a small oil and gas company out of Minnesota called Cedar Creek Oil and Gas. Our group has, under a state exploration license, a little bit less than 500,000 acres of state land, and we also have leases to about 15,000 acres of mental health trust lands. We're actually almost 10 years into this project. We've been slowed down at several points. Oil and gas tax changes, PPT, ACEs, had some negative impacts on our group and some unintended consequences actually in PPT that which we actually had to get rectified in ACEs before we would move forward. Availability of drill rigs has been a real problem. We've had partners quit, and frankly, we've got others that have lost interest because of no big early discovery, which is something that we at Doyon never really expected. We knew it was going to be a long, hard slog. Later this calendar year, we will start to pay the state of Alaska yearly rentals of $3 an acre once we take multiple year leases, which is the way the state license program is set up. Any production from these lands would require a 12.5% gross value royalty paid to the state, as well as the applicable production taxes. There are about 43,000 acres of Doyon lands in the Nanana Basin, which are not part of the state mental health lands venture that which we head up today, and nor are these lands a focus of any current exploration. This is obviously a very frontier basin, as Bob mentioned. It's very underexplored. We've only got one deep hole, which we drilled, and there's a whole lot more that needs to be learned about this basin, and it's a risky place to deploy your capital. The major programs really of our group have been a large 2D seismic program in 2005 and a 2009 drilling program where we went to about 11,000 feet on the flank of the basin, really, really close to the road system, and it was kind of easy to get to. Some of the logistics actually drove some of that drilling decision. But we've learned a lot of very interesting information, some of which Bob has shared with you, and we're excited about the area. Since 2010, when we took over the operatorship, we've undertaken multiple efforts into reviewing the existing data, reanalyzing the drill cores from our well, acquiring new soils geochemistry. We've licensed proprietary geophysics and that we hadn't really looked at or known about before, and we've gathered new geophysics as well, mostly gravity. The recent work and the implications, as Bob mentioned, I think this is really an oil as well as a natural gas opportunity, and we really know this mostly from the well data, source rock geochemistry, and the new geophysics that we've either licensed and gathered have really redefined the shape and depths of the basin. And we believe, as Bob pointed out, the basin is substantially deeper than previously thought. It's good for both oil and gas generation. And there's a much larger potential hydrocarbon endowment as a result of that. We will start a 125-mile 2D seismic program starts this week, kind of further demonstrating our commitment to the basin. It's a multi-million-dollar program. And it's going to be in an area of the basin that has never really been explored. No seismic has been shot before, but one we think now has tremendous promise based on our reassessment of gravity and the other seismic that we've gathered in the past. And this will start this week, as I mentioned. It'll run through March. Nana is not Cook Inlet or the North Slope. I mean, it's a tough place to attract investment at this stage of understanding about the basin. Besides, all we have is these encouraging results. No real discoveries, no history of development or production like Cook Inlet or the North Slope. We've got no oil and gas infrastructure like the Cook Inlet does. Certainly, we have unsettled gas markets. Is the ASAP line going to happen? Is there going to be a bigger export line? We've got gas by truck maybe coming to Fairbanks. All those things put incredible risk on the project, just on the markets alone. We've also got an oil tax in this frontier basin, which is the same as Prudhoe Bay. It's not the same as Cook Inlet. And frankly, that's something that somebody ought to take a look at. And we're going to bring it up with some other people later, I think. We've had much larger risks and burdens compared to Cook Inlet or even parts of the North Slope, we believe, for any exploration project. On the upside, with the new information, oil prospectivity in the area, we really think that there could be somewhere between, I guess, 300 million to as much as a billion barrels of recoverable oil in the Nana Basin, although they're likely in multiple smaller fields. I think that's something that Bob also mentioned, and we think that there should be plenty of thermogenic natural gas as well as propane. So we're not going to be finding giant fields on the North Slope. It's more like what you would see in Cook Inlet or maybe in the lower 48. And really, in that light, you know, we believe that Nanana is as deserving as Cook Inlet for enhanced drilling incentives. And I guess my final points really are that you know, we started out, as I mentioned, at a 20% equity position in this project, but we liked the opportunity at first and even more so now based on the more recent technical work. And we think that we've got more reasons to make this work than most companies. Interior is the home to most of our shareholders. Fairbanks is where our home offices are. Things happening in the Nanana Basin create job opportunities for Interior residents, especially in nearby communities in Nanana and Minto, where we have many shareholders. Nanana is also the hub of the great river system in the Interior, and we've got many Doyen Region villages. And with the propane possibilities, we like that option as well, the possibility of being able to produce propane near Nanana, ship propane down the river system. And, of course, Odoyan owns multiple oil and gas field service companies, drilling, remote camp services, security, emergency medical services, engineering, and pipeline construction. Those are all reasons why we've got, we think the desire and to make this thing happen, and we want to make it happen. But the risks are huge, and with the bill in front of you, it would allow this project to move forward much more quickly. And those are the end of my comments. And if I have any questions, or if I can try, there were a number of questions that popped up during Bob's comments, and I can try to go back and answer some of those, or if there are new questions.
Questions from the committee.
I have a question.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. You said that you have drilled one well already. Could you tell me more or less in a range what the price of an exploratory well is in that area?
It's going to come down to where it is as much as anything. And I know the question came up with where the $25 million come from. That was a Cook Inlet jackup rig legislation number. We've independently, through consultants that aren't owned by Doyon, Infinite Consulting Group, come up with a range of costs for wells, and depending upon the depth, an 11,000-foot well is going to cost right at about $25 million in the Nanana Basin. The well that we drilled, and we're talking about there, in a central location, which is the areas that we are currently focusing on. The well that we drilled at Nanana a couple of years ago was a little bit shy of $20 million, but that was only 4 miles off the road system on an existing right-of-way, relatively easy access compared to some of the other locations that we're looking at.
Thank you.
Mr. Murray, this is Representative Feige. If you drilled two wells, say your Nunavak 1 well came in at $20 million, as you just stated. If you were to drill two wells, say you found an indication of something and then offset to confirm it, what would the sum total of those two wells be?
They're not going to be $20 million each. I think I can say that much. There's a depth issue. It's hard to say, quite honestly. Yeah. But it's it would be some fraction of the $20 to $25 million. I just don't know, because it depends upon how far you're offsetting it. You know, how far out is it from the existing location? Probably not the right person to answer that question, but it won't be the same amount of money, because you've already paid for the logistics to get the rig in there.
Okay, fair enough. Any other questions from the committee?
I have one more question.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. One more question. The state currently provides a 40% credit on the well that was drilled, the explored
well?
Correct. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to try and figure out on the economics here. A 40% tax credit is generated. Are you also able to take the expenditure, the investment, and convert that into the tax credit at 25%, the base rate? In other words, under the...
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Okay, so if we had $25 million, a $25 million well, and it was 100% tax credit on that, and then additionally you could take that $25 million at cost that was expended and take that and convert it into a transferable tax credit at 25%.
Then no, we can't do that. We can't do both.
Okay. You cannot do both.
Okay.
No. Thank you.
And one question again from myself, Representative Feige. You currently have plans to go forward with this drilling program?
We have a seismic program. It starts this week. We do not have plans to drill at this point in time. No, we believe we would like to, but. This is a tough place. I don't actually, even with our current investor group, I only have one of our group is even participating in the seismic program.
Okay. If, say, by some miracle the governor's House Bill 110 was to pass, would that make a change in, would that alter your decision whether or not to go forward or not, even without these incentives?
I think the issues are almost separate. I mean, they're obviously linked somewhat, but I think it's really the risk of frontier exploration is sort of the overwhelming issue. The tax rate is maybe a subsidiary or ancillary aspect of that larger question. And so the geologic risks, the litigation risks, the market risks, I think, are as profound or probably more so than the tax, but at least equally so.
Sounds like a lot of risk, huh? Representative Seaton?
Yes, there is.
thank you. And just to clarify, under the tax bill, ACES is there. You would qualify for the 50,000 barrel per day small producer tax credit a proportion of that if you went up to 100,000 barrels a day.
That is correct.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, at this point we'll just take a brief at ease. Based on some of the questions that Mr. Swenson got during his first round of presentation, Representative Foster had questions about some of the wells and information collected in the Nome area. I have some questions about Copper River Basin, and I wonder if Mr. Swenson, if you could kind of you kind of skimmed over some of those slides that you have of those particular basins, and maybe speak to the prospectivity of those other basins that were sort of glossed over in your presentation.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, I'll just get this, excuse me, this slide up. Do I need to come on for the record again?
Yes, if you
would. For the record, my name is Bob Swenson, the state geologist and director of the State Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And I'm going to bring up a slide, or a number of slides here, of some of the other basins within interior Alaska, if I may.
Do we have copies of those in here? Should we look for them, or are these?
Yes,
they're in there. Yeah. Part of the presentation.
I see. No page
number. Okay, as part of a statewide look at all the available data that we could get our hands on, we looked at each one of the energy areas with AEA. I already mentioned that. I won't go through this again. Part of that, of course, was looking at the sedimentary basins, including the Copper River, the Susitna Basin, the Yukon-Tanana Basin, the Selawik and other basins in western Alaska, and specifically trying to understand what available data there is. If you look at the statewide picture, clearly, the two basins that have primarily the highest amount of data, of course, are North Slope and Cook Inlet. Second behind that would be basins like the Copper River Basin and in the southeast, the Gulf of Alaska, where a number of wells were drilled back in the 1950s all the way through the 1980s from onshore to offshore. Remember that Catala was the first oil field in Alaska that was discovered basically producing out of a seep in the Catala area back in the early 1900s. And so all of the basins that of all the basins that we see in the state, there was a first pass look at, okay, what is the potential in any one of these basins? One of the things that we use for that is this gravity information. And you saw in the story that I told you about Nanana going from what we thought was somewhere around 15,000 to 18,000 feet deep. Now, given additional information and density of the rock, that's how they gauge gravity data is the density. And they were able to get that from that deep well. Think it could be up to 25,000 feet, and of course that's in combination with the seismic data that Doyen had shot earlier on. And so of those basins, the Nanana Basin and the Copper River Basins primarily has the most information. The Susitna Basin actually has a fair amount of seismic as well as two or three wells, but is broke up into two different sub-basins that is basically in the same sense that Nanana was. I unfortunately don't have the slides associated with those basins, but if you move up into the northern part of the state, this is the Copper River Basin, and I'll address that here now. And you can also see to the south all the wells that were drilled in the Gulf of Alaska area. That was a very highly prospective area for a number of years. In the Copper River Basin area, what you see, and from that well data, as well as the other information that was gathered, both seismic and gravity, that's a very broad, open, shallow basin. That doesn't have the great thicknesses that we see in the Nanana Basin. The Nanana Basin was developed because we call it a pull-apart basin. The bottom basically drops out of it because of those big strike-slip systems. Sometimes you get what's called a transtensional or a pull-apart basin. Copper River Basin is actually more of a flexure. It's more of a flexure because of that, and so you end up with a broad, open depression that collects the sediment, and that's the Copper River part of that. However, the interesting thing about the Copper River Basin is that you end up with sub-tertiary stratigraphy that has the potential to generate oil. That is why we see the oil in the Cook Inlet. The oil in the Cook Inlet does not come from the coals. It does not come from, like, we, you know, the whole discussion in the Nanana. It comes with what we call Mesozoic rocks. It's the stratigraphy or the rock package. It's much, much older. It was actually deposited in a marine setting. During the time the rock was deposited, it was a shelf system just like the North Slope. And the Copper River Basin actually has that type of stratigraphy under it. Unfortunately, the amount that it's buried, the level of the depth, the thermal maturity of it doesn't appear to have gotten to the situation where it's generated that. The jury is still out in certain areas, but it's a much different basin, and that's kind of brings to the point that each one of these basins has attributes that we have to understand. It's very, very difficult to broad brush all the basins and say that they're all going to be the same, because they each have their own similarities as well as different and also varying amounts of data that's available to you.
Representative Seaton, question.
Thank you. So you're talking about Copper River not mm-hmm. getting thermally reactive enough for mm-hmm. oil formation. Was it then gas prone, or are we saying that there's not anything there?
No, Representative Seaton, through the chair. No, I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I do know that there is some fairly robust prospects that the Native Corporation in the Copper River Basin have for natural gas in that Mesozoic section. The real problem in the deeper part, not the tertiary section that we've been talking about, but the Mesozoic section, is our lack of information. It's how much do we know? There's a lot going on. I promise not to go too much here. What happens is that because there's so much deformation and things going on, and then you erode, and then the tertiary deposit is on top of it, and what you end up with is very complex geology underneath relatively flat-lying tertiary sediments, and it's hard to understand what's going on down there. And you can partially see it in seismic, and sometimes you get pieces of information from drilling. And so that underlying sequence is very difficult to understand in the Copper River Basin. So the risk... Certainly part of the risk in Copper River Basin is lack of information, not negative information.
Would improved seismic technology increase?
Certainly.
I don't know, how old is the seismic information from the Copper River Basin?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the most recent data is the 80s, but I don't remember for sure. I'll have to get back with you on that.
Okay.
If we move up to, now you look at the inset map on the upper left-hand corner. We're up in the Kotzebue area here. The Hope Basin is the offshore basin. The Selig Trough, you see, that's been discussed on a number of fronts, the Kotzebue Basin, which is offshore. And then, interestingly enough, the Kobuk Basin. And the Kobuk Basin is not, it's not the yellow color that we've been using for tertiary, because the Kobuk actually is part of the Mesozoic. And I won't go into the history of the Brooks Range, but what's interesting about that is that within that sequence, within the Kobuk, and it's a Cretaceous age rock, there's a tremendous amount of coal, the stipple pattern that you see on this map, and it's in that report that I showed you. All the information we have on coal is in that book. And so you have the Selawik Trough to the south, which is another one of these tertiary basins, a younger basin that has the coals and the sandstones and whatnot in it. But the best we can understand in the Selawik Basin is it's around, with the current gravity, it's around 10,000 feet. So did not get very deep, and your chance of thermogenic hydrocarbons, if that's true, are going to be dramatically lessened. Other forms of gas in the form of shallow biogenic gas, certainly, if you have the right number of conditions, that could happen. The problem in any one of these basins is you do not see wells. Offshore there were wells. Offshore in the offshore basins are much deeper, much thicker. But these onshore basins here actually have very limited data. And we all have been out in many of these areas, and we can see the outcrops. There's not a lot to go on. The tundra covers up a lot of the information that we need to see. So you're basically looking at remote sensing to help you try to get a feel for what that basin geometry might be. And the Yukon Basin, that's another one that's incredibly intriguing. It's very large aerially. However, it's made up, again, of these two sub-basins. It's not the same type of basin as the Nanana, the strike-slip basin. It's more of a flexural thing. But it as well, according to Doyon's data, has a possibility of liquid hydrocarbon source rock out of the coals. And that's something that we, the State Geologic Survey, are going to be focusing quite heavily on in our sampling programs, is to see what we can do to help understand what the distribution of that rock type is. And I will be quiet from there, Chairman Feige, I don't know how much more you want me to go in on that.
Members of the committee have questions. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't see a slide on the Norton Sound Basin. Mm-hmm. There. Can you maybe touch on that?
Certainly. Yeah, sorry.
Hey, he gets to push DGGS. He gets to push Norton Sound.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Foster.
And while we're there, also, as you're touching on the Norton Sound area, I also noticed on slide 2 that there were some deposits there onshore, knowing that it's more cost-effective to develop onshore versus offshore. I was just wondering if you knew anything about the two yellow spots that I'm seeing there near Nome, and I hadn't heard that there was any drilling out there, and so I didn't know if there was any data.
Representative Foster, through the chair, and I very much appreciate you asking that question because it's important in the different ways that geologists portray the geology. The map that you see that has the yellow, which represents tertiary basins, and some of these areas are huge, like the Nanana Basin goes from the Yukon all the way down almost to McCarthy by the looks of it. A geologist is normally very absolute. They say, okay, if I go to this outcrop, it's tertiary, therefore I map it as tertiary, and it says this surface map says tertiary. The unfortunate part of that is that even though it may be only 100 feet thick at the surface, you still map it at the surface like that. And so in many of those areas where you see the yellow going onshore, that part of the rock is very, very thin, and their prospectivity is very limited. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we tried to do in this report was to say, no, let's get to where the prospectivity is. And you can see on the slide that I just put up the yellow stippled pattern. That's the deepest part of the Norton place. That's to the south there. And you can see the exploration wells that were drilled out in the 80s there. That basin actually gets relatively deep, and that's where the prospectivity is in that offshore region. The tertiary section onshore has very limited prospectivity for that, unfortunately. And that actually goes for most of the basins in the Bering Strait region. The onshore extent of that rock becomes very, very thin. The basin feathers out, in other words. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Norton Basin, this is a MMS, which is now BOEM, study that was done back in, I believe, the 80s, 1986. it gives you an idea of the complexities in that basin. There's two what they call sub-basins. They drilled a number of wells. They actually saw a fair amount of potential out there, but again, the cost of exploration and the types of hydrocarbons that they saw in those wells. Of course, you have to look at the expiration chance of success on any one of these things for your investment. This just goes down through, and I won't go into all the details, and I can certainly get you all the details for what was discovered out there, well, not discovered, but what was encountered out there. But this just gives you a basic understanding of it, and one of the key things is that they do believe they have a thermogenic system. They did see trace oil, but just trace, in a couple of the wells, and they saw a fair amount of reservoir-quality rock and a lot of structure. Those are the big key things that have to go towards generating prospects. Now, the cost of exploration on the other side of that whole coin, then, you have to look at what the potential size of any one of these things are. I mean, we can just need to go to the Chukchi Sea and the amount of money that Shell spent on the lease sale to understand the size of the potential prospects there. Whether that's in this scenario or not, that's another question.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Swenson. Obviously, there's certainly no shortage of information to absorb on this particular subject. We're about out of time. I'm sure we'll continue our discussion here on House Bill 276. On Wednesday, we will hear House Bill 298 as well as 296. House Bill 298 is exemptions from the mining tax as it relates to gravel. By Representative Seaton. At this point, we are adjourned until 3 o'clock Wednesday.